My guest this morning is Ólafur Grímsson. He is the president of Iceland. He is in a studio in Reykjavik, and we're talking about the remarkable recovery of his country after the financial collapse. Mr. President, what was it in your feeling, in your gut, actually, that told you that you could not sign a bill bailing out the banks? Why did you find that so repugnant?
Well, there were really two fundamental strands in my analysis. One was that the European financial system was based on allowing private banks to operate all over Europe. And if we suddenly started to introduce the rule that if they failed, they could send the bill to ordinary people, fishermen, farmers, doctors and nurses and others, it would be tantamount to privatizing the profits and letting the bankers become extremely rich if they were successful, but then sending them a signal that if they failed, they could send the bill back to ordinary people. And that was not only fundamentally unfair, but it would also be contrary to the fundamental principles of the free market. And then, in addition to that, the financial burdens that was involved in that first agreement threaten the very economic sovereignty of my country in the coming decades. But in addition to that, and that was perhaps the core of it, you could analyze it financially and economically backwards and forwards as many people did. But when all the complicated analysis had been swept away, I was left with a fundamental choice between what was interpreted as the paramount financial interest of the financial markets in Europe with respect to Iceland, and on the other, the democratic will of my people. And I came to the conclusion that our society, like Europe or the Western world, is more about democracy than it is about financial market. If we start saying that financial markets are more important than democracy, we are, in my opinion, entering into a very risky journey with respect to Western values and what we are all about. And looking at Europe these very days, where the interest of the financial markets have in many cases been deemed to be supreme, I think people have forgotten that Europe's most important contribution to the world is not the free market system, it's democracy and human rights. We have countries in Asia and other parts of the world that are excellent market economies, but they have very little democracy.
One of the more striking things that you've talked about is that while Western governments, Western democracies, were pressuring you to pay off the debts of those private banks, the one country with which you were able to have a constructive dialogue was China. How do you explain that?
Well, that's a very interesting case. In those first months, in October of 2008, November, December, and into January 2009, we were faced with a situation that all the European Union countries had come together to support Britain and the Netherlands and their request that Iceland would shoulder this extraordinary debt burden of a single private bank, a debt burden of the scale, to give you an example, because many people have not realized this, a debt responsibility of the scale that if you take into account the relative size of the British and the Icelandic economy would have been equal to the people of Britain shouldering the responsibility for almost $1 trillion. $1 trillion because of the operation of one bank. Right. That is almost the complete size of the European Emergency Fund that people have been talking about in recent weeks. So we were faced with this situation that we faced a unified front of European countries with small exceptions like the Faroe Islands and our friends in Poland, who were pressurizing us to bow to the claims from Britain and the Netherlands. And with respect to the United States, which had been a traditional ally of Iceland for a long time, we simply faced a situation that they didn't care, that they described in private conversations that they were simply sorry, but there was nothing they could do. So where could we turn? So I started, in cooperation with the Prime Minister of the time and our Foreign Minister at the time, to instigate a dialogue through a letter and then discussions, letter to the President of China, Hu Jintao, and the discussions with their ambassador. And what followed was an extraordinarily sophisticated dialogue that we conducted with the Chinese leadership for the following 4 or 5 months, which ultimately led to an agreement between the Central Bank of Iceland and the Central Bank of China, and a very high-level delegation by one of the major Chinese leaders to Iceland sometime later, where they expressed support in terms of investment and loans and so on and so forth. And as an observer of international politics for many decades and a former professor, I found it remarkable the level of sophistication that the Chinese leadership showed in this dialogue, as well as the goodwill towards Iceland, when all our traditional friends and allies were either simply not interested or showed strong hostility.
I'm wondering, though, in the fallout of all of this, Iceland's position today, a projected growth rate of something like 3%, but how difficult is it for your government to go into the market to finance debt on the international markets? Are investors turning away from Iceland?
No.
They're coming back?
No. You could even say our problem has been that there's been too much interest in investing in Iceland.
And
with respect to the financial markets, we had a great success earlier this year when the Icelandic authorities raised money in the international financial market. So all the indicators in the financial markets in the last year or year and a half have been very positive. Rio Tinto is now investing in Iceland for $500 million. It was, in fact, the first international investment that Rio Tinto decided to engage in following the international financial crisis. Similarly, foreign companies are investing in data storage centers. And the reason is, or the reasons are perhaps a number of the reasons. One is, of course, that throughout this crisis, the country and the nation has demonstrated considerable capability to return to a successful economy in the long run and show the responsibility that foreign investors appreciate. But above that, the strong natural resources of Iceland, the clean energy, the water, the ocean resources, as well as the extraordinary nature that Iceland has to offer, all of this has helped us, together with the IT sector and the high-tech sector, to strengthen our exports in a formidable way. And that is one of the reasons why we are coming out of this crisis in a relatively short time. And let me also mention other things that your listeners might find interesting. After the banks collapsed, we suddenly realized that these big Icelandic banks, like banks in America and Europe, are no longer traditional banks. They have, in fact, become high-tech companies, hiring engineers, mathematicians, computer scientists, right, and many others. And when they collapsed, there was suddenly a wealth of talent available in the market. So IT companies and high-tech companies who had had extraordinary growth potential before but couldn't realize it because the banks were outbidding them for these qualified people suddenly could now hire engineers and computer scientists and mathematicians and designers and programmers and so on. So almost the entire IT and high-tech sector in Iceland has in the last 2 years or so had a much success, more successful period than in the years leading up to the banking crisis. So the lesson of that is that if your nation wants to be competitive in the creative sectors of the 21st century economy, IT, high tech, and so on, a big banking sector, even a very successful banking sector, is in fact bad news for the creative sectors of our economies.
Mr. President, as you said, Iceland is it's an integrated society. It is politically coherent and cohesive. It is a small nation. Do you think that what Iceland did in the crisis and coming out of it is applicable in places such as Greece and Italy and Ireland and Spain? Would what you did work within the Eurozone?
Well, it depends how you look at it. Of course, the difference is we had our own currency, we still have, whereas they are bound by the framework of the euro. But in addition to that, as we have mentioned in our discussion, we decided to go against many of the financial orthodoxies that are still prevailing within the eurozone. It's right, Iceland is a small country. We are not a big nation. But we are a highly advanced Western society. And I don't accept the argument that because Iceland is so small, it was possible for us to recover after the crisis earlier than others. On the contrary, you can look at Iceland as a kind of laboratory where some of these conflicts and the challenges and the measures and the recovery policies come out more clearly and in a more transparent way than in a more complicated society. So what has succeeded in Iceland should also be successful in other countries. But I have consistently had the position that I am not going to offer other countries concrete advice. What I can describe is what we have done in Iceland, what are the lessons we have drawn, what are the primary elements in our difficult journey, and it has been difficult, no doubt about it, in the last 3 years. And then other people have to draw conclusions for their countries.
Let me ask you finally, Mr. President, we live in an era of, as you said, and certainly since the war, market dominance, where capital is preferred over labor, where financial workings are more important than productivity, it seems. Do you think that the world is going to turn around and come away from that way of thinking?
Well, I hope so. We have learned many lessons from this difficult experience here in Iceland. And all these lessons point in the direction that you have just described. But this crisis, as I have tried to describe to you, has also brought out a fundamental dilemma for our Western societies. And that is this. Is democracy more important for us than the financial markets? And this is perhaps the core of the challenge that you're witnessing these very days in Europe. It's also a strong element in the difficult situation that the United States still finds itself. We somehow have to find a way where democracy can prevail, even if we have to take our societies out of a profound financial crisis. If we start sacrificing democratic elements of our societies for financial expediency, we have, in my opinion, entered a very dangerous journey.
Mr. President, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure to meet you on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ólafur Grímsson is the president of Iceland, and this morning he was in a studio in Reykjavik. You are listening to the Sunday edition Across Canada on CBC Radio 1. My name is Michael Enright.